And so, Jan, we have so many warriors today on this show. You know, it's Women's History Month. And so we're going to be starting with Joan of Arc.
There you go.
And then Matilda Joslyn Gage, Sally Rush Wagner is going to be talking about her, and another incredible.
I am familiar with her, and I've heard Sally Rush Wagner speak before about Matilda Gage.
Joslyn Gage.
Yeah. And what an amazing woman, and a part of a feminist history that has really been not talked about and is a very important part of it.
Yeah, she's been...
I'm not going to say too much because I know
she'll
talk about it.
Nancy Cole, would you put on your microphone over there? Are you that familiar with... not putting you on the spot, but I can't imagine you aren't familiar with Matilda Joslyn Gage.
Yes.
Why do you think that... Because she does not get the recognition, say, the Susan B. Anthony or Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Lucretia Mott. Why do you think that?
I think the opportunity, and I think that because Lucretia Mott and Susan B. Anthony, and by the way, I went to the Women's Museum in Seneca Falls last summer. Woo. But I think that may also be part of it, it depends on opportunity. It depends on people living together and being part of a community that makes itself sort of known in the country, with Susan B. Anthony and Lucretia Mott, for example.
You know, I haven't, you know, read extensively of Matilda Joslyn Gage, but this is one of the most brilliant minds, male or female, I have ever come across.
Mm-hmm. And that may be why they tried to hide her for so long.
Exactly. And you know, the more you get into her, the more you realize that she was literally fighting. She realized that women, so to speak, in the eyes of the law and in the eyes of the church, so to speak, did not exist. And so this woman was fighting for our existence. And to tell you the truth, I think that her mind was so fierce. And she had such integrity, and particularly when she and Elizabeth Cady Stanton then took after the church, Joan of Arc, I think it's up to us to discover her again, because Gloria Steinem, just a couple years ago, read, you know, from her book, and she didn't tell anybody that she was reading from Matilda Joslyn Gage. And Gage was talking about sexual trafficking and sexual slavery, you know, back in the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't just referring to African-American slavery. And so her work was so powerful that everyone thought it was a contemporary writer. Mm-hmm. And this was in 2009. Mm-hmm. And so, okay, well, I'm jumping the gun here, but is that kind of exciting day? It's March. And I thought, wow, Joan of Arc, et cetera. I'll put on a little music here by another great, great woman, Hildegard de Bingham. And then I'm going to come back with our guest, Nancy Cole, you've already met. And you're going to meet the Joan of Arc, who plays Joan of Arc, I should say, Magali Noss. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Good. Okay. Well, let's just get in the proper, I think, mood, and then we'll come back with these two guests. The music of Hildegard de Bingham, and the reason I put this one on is that this is Only the Devil Laughed. Again, that's Hildegard de Benjamin. But her cut we chose was Only the Devil Laughed, and that was deliberate. Well, Nancy Cole, the Guerrilla Theater, continues in the tradition of the late fabulous Susan Hussey, just bringing outstanding drama to our area. And Joan of Arc, those microphones, they will be dragons. Just go ahead and pull it down a bit. Just get it over with, and then it's done for all of us. What, I find the mystery of Joan of Arc always just amazing, but sometimes I find that with our contemporary lives, with everything happening so fiercely, one kind of, it was odd when I was watching it, and I thought, this is amazing, what she did was miraculous, really.
Miraculous.
And yet, and it kind of, I find historically, it's almost looked like, that was then, when those kind of things happened then, kind of, like the virgin birth, of Jesus, that you kind of think, that happened then, and it's not that you don't believe it, but you don't know how to believe it in a way. And I was just fascinated. I really was. And so why were you part of choosing this play to come now? And if so, why?
Well, you see this woman next to me.
I sure do.
I mean, it's a kind of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. When Magdalene remarked to me last year that someone had told her she ought to do the Lark, I said, of course. Of course you should do the Lark. And so we set about doing it, and because it's the Guerrilla where we can more or less choose what we would like to do, and also realizing some of the other limitations, like when it was done originally in New York and also in London, which was 1955, they did it with 28 people. Well, we couldn't do it with 28 people, so we had to sort of begin to think about how we might be able to do it with a fewer people. And that in itself is a challenge and an interesting kind of thing, too, because of the nature of modern dramaturgy, in which people are used to seeing people play double roles. We were suddenly able to do it, and Magalie is a perfect person to do Joan.
She is. Magalie, you really were just transcendent. You really were on the stage. And the lighting is excellent, Nancy, which is important for a play like this. The lighting is critical, I think.
Oh, yes. And a wonderful lighting designer from St. Petersburg, Megan Byrne, did the lighting.
And so, Magalie, yes. Joan is always this marvelous enigma. And mm-hmm. and wasn't that the purpose of, because actually this is adapted by Lillian Hellman.
Yes.
And it's by Jean
Anouilh.
Anouilh, is that how you pronounce his name? Mm-hmm. Anouilh. And he took a little different ending to the story of Joan of Arc. And so did you know a lot about Joan of Arc or what before you took this role?
I didn't know that much about it. But because it's French history, we kind of knew that there was a court chick from Lorraine who freed who freed France and pushed the English into the sea. That's all we knew. But it's what's really interesting is that it has followed me through my life, and so I kind of felt like I had to play the role. Just with the different things that I've done, I went to a school that was called St. Michael.
Uh-huh.
Which is the archangel that speaks to her.
Yes.
And then I moved to a street that was called the Virgin Street. And then I moved to an apartment with my mother behind a statue of Joan of Arc. And I'm from 2 hours away from where she's from. So it was kind of, although I didn't know much, there was always this little calling of that her and I had something in common.
Yeah, I don't know why, because I didn't read it carefully. I didn't realize that you are from France.
Yes.
I noticed the accent, and I thought, my word, that sounds French to me.
It is.
And so, at least in our history books here, we see Joan of Arc as the savior of France, so to speak. Without her, perhaps France would have just been a province of England.
And yeah.
And so, but even though she is that important, even though we don't know anything about her really here, in your growing up as a French citizen, that you really didn't know that much about her either, even though you were surrounded with all her iconography.
I mean, we knew, but it was 600 years ago, so It's the kind of history that you know. You're like, oh, yeah, like the French Revolution. You learn about it in school. Right. And then you just kind of, yeah, well, I know the dates and I know the main people. And, you know, it's just part of history. So it's not that big of a deal for us. You know what I mean? And that's one thing that I kind of had to realize while doing this show is how much of a big deal she actually was. Because for me, it was, yeah, she did something remarkable, but, you know, it's just part of history. And so I kind of had to learn how to step back and see the miracle and see the strength and see the power behind this woman, which is, you know, you can't really learn that in history books. You kind of have to feel it. So,
well, and I think that is a fascinating of Jean Anouilh's play, you know, in that he isn't trying because, you know, and I was really watching you, and I think you really made Joan come alive in a way that I could utterly and totally relate to, because I've never known quite how to make it out. You know, I have no doubt that she heard voices, you know, whether they were spiritual or just kind of slightly maybe schizophrenic. You know, it really didn't make that much difference. But particularly watching you on stage at night, I thought, wow, here is this peasant girl, uneducated. She doesn't even know how to ride a horse, let alone have a horse. And yet she's this brilliant horseman, fearless in battle. And you say, whoa, you know, this is a girl out, you know, tending the sheep, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of struck me in a way it has never struck me before, that, well, where did this come from?
Right.
And did it strike you? And where did you think it came from to Joan?
I mean, I think that it was definitely something divine that spoke to her. I believe that it was those saints who spoke to her, yeah. And I believe that to translate that into modern society, maybe it's just that, you know, we can call it karma or whatever, that if you really put out that kind of desire and need and positive energy, then is going to filter through your body and you're going to be able to do amazing things. And so that's something that was a bit difficult for me, was to get the divinity of it, because we are in a society where we're not really religious or we don't believe in that kind of stuff. But so I kind of translated it for me in order for me to understand within my body that, well, maybe if you just ask for something really, really strong, it might happen.
And it is interesting because, Nancy, don't you see it too? Because you're directing, Magali, that you physically, you see, in other words, even though you're a very small, petite woman, you can really see when you're up there, you know, arguing with these people and very, but you can see the power in this young girl, and you realize, and you know, the English, Viscount or whoever he is, perhaps appreciates your ability more than any of the others.
It does.
But we see it physically. And so I thought, well, I thought, and I realized, I thought, you know, this just can't be, you know, just acting method, that she's really kind of, well, Nancy,
channeling something.
Huh? Give me help here, Nancy.
All right. I'll give you some help. This play is called The Lark.
Yes.
And that's the metaphor for Joan. She soars above. She cries out this crazy song, as Warwick says, at the top of the second act, and it speaks to the soldiers of France. She accepts the soldiers for what they are. It is fundamentally the church and its ecclesiastical judges which give her the trial. This is not a civil trial.
Uh-uh.
This is a trial by churchmen. And, you know, I ran across a really interesting thing. Do you remember the Templars?
Oh, wow.
Right. There came actually from the French king, who was Philip the Fair, of all things, in like 30 years before Joan, decided he needed the money that the Templars had accumulated in the Crusades, and he sent out a death order. And all the Templars were destroyed on October 13th, Friday the 13th, in about 1290. And so the whole idea that there is a kind of vengeful relationship between the kingdom and the nobles of the society, plus the church, because the Pope was forced to accede to this. Hence, Templars were wiped out all across Europe. I mean, we've had the Da Vinci Code. We've had tremendous interest in the Masonic organization and its fundamental ideals of the Templars as well. So suddenly, it seems that this idea of Joan wresting a national ideal from the dominance of what's been an international organization, the church, and finding French people who respond to this and honor it by wanting to get a monarchy together. I mean, the monarchy's certainly been together for a long time, but it didn't help that Charlie's dad was mad. But here he is, a kind of wavering fellow, and Joan comes in and says, nonsense, we can do this. We can mount a siege. Now, the French had had a miserable defeat at Agincourt, or Agincourt, as we say. And that was 1415, when she was 4 years old. She wasn't there. But at the same time, it was in everybody's consciousness that there might be a zeitgeist that comes along. And Joan is the zeitgeist.
Absolutely. It was so amazing because it is so contemporary for now. Because
yes.
In a way, we were hoping Barack Obama was the zeitgeist. You know, really, we were. You know, with all the challenges that we are facing right now, and also you realize the people are in a lower scale. And Joan believes in the people. She believes in the soldiers. She believes in the human being as the highest work of God, so to speak. And
right.
Wow. This,
and we do, too.
Yes, we do. We do. And so I that's why I thought that you deliberately chose it. Because I thought, my word, this is so utterly contemporary. You know, not necessarily that the power is embodied so much in one single church right now, but it's kind of a whole aspect of fundamentalism, which is, maybe it's not the Inquisition, but it's close enough that you realize that women throughout the world are being dominated by the forces of these fundamental religions. And it is not just oppressive, you know, for many women, it's their lives, that I thought the analogy to Joan of Arc and her in that milieu or archetypes, or you're calling it the zeitgeist very appropriately, it was just spot on. It really was. And I thought, and I saw it for a power that I really have to congratulate all of you. I thought the acting was fabulous, but you kind of encapsulate Joan, you know, with that it makes no difference if she's not educated, she can think. And she's rational, and she understands people, and she is a very admirable human being. We see a real human being there who happens to be a young woman, you know?
Right, which is everything wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And so when we're watching the arguments with the inquisitors, you think, wow. You know, we are to save your soul. This has nothing to do with politics or nationalism. And one realized that, in a sense, this had to be divine inspiration to give you the kind of ability under that kind of pressure. Mm-hmm. You're being kept in a terrible dungeon. You're being, you know, every night you're having to fend off. You're not getting any sleep. And you think, wow. And I, you know, it was just very powerful. And I repeat, it really kind of is so contemporary in so many ways to our world right now.
Absolutely. And it does strike me that Sarah Palin is a strong kind of voice of women that, while she is not consciously or solely speaking for women, nevertheless, she is an icon of women. And in many ways, there's a sort of St. Joan quality to her. And it's not necessarily in everything she says, certainly, but in the way in which she's charismatic. And I think that Magalie captures that about St. Joan, too, that there is a charisma that is speaking to us. And how can we identify it? How can we find ourselves in it?
You know, Nancy, you're bringing up a really interesting point. And you know, nothing has kind of horrified me more than the pragmatism, if you will, of the Barack Obama and so many of his followers and the moderate aspect of the Democratic Party. And somehow, and I agree, Sarah Palin, I totally disagree with her philosophies, et cetera. You know, I mean, she's not an ideologue at all. And she's an opportunist, I think, of the highest order. But she has captured something of the deep sense of the maverick and the rebel who stands opposed to this entrenched power. And the teabaggers, even though you see them off the wall, and the racism they demonstrate is only too familiar to women who have been fighting these rearguard actions long before even Roe versus Wade came into force. We recognize this kind of hatred. But they, unfortunately, far more than progressives and Democrats, they're into that deep milieu of the pain and the suffering and the exclusion of people from the power process. And it terrifies me, you know, because wrong people, just like Hitler rode the Nazi, you know, the terrible pain and suffering of the German people, that this is a force that's apolitical. And if you're in tune with it, however warped it is, it's a deeply personal, almost an emotional thing that you relate to, or maybe deeper than emotional. And frankly, it frightens me. It frightens me right now because I think it's potentially so dangerous. And I just can't understand why the progressives have allowed this, you know, have not fought the bank bailouts, have not fought for the people, you know, and instead very pragmatically thinking, well, we can't upset it too much. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. And they are losing, so to speak, this whole thing that they don't seem to get.
I think that there are a lot of parallels in the career of St. Joan with our contemporary situations. Yes,
I mean, that's one of the reasons why we did it.
Yes.
Too, is that, you know, when it came up and the discussion started with Nancy, I said, well, but don't you think it's, I don't know, will people be able to relate to it? And she said, yes. It's very timely. It's very current and it's coming at the right time.
It really is. And so, and you know, I was so thinking, every time I go to the Gorilla now since Susan Hussey has died, you know, I'm so aware because I think it's very courageous for you to do this play now. I mean, you know, because it's a period piece and people, frankly, are so preoccupied with very serious problems, you know, not the least of which is bread, you know, and paying the rent and all this kind of stuff for mortgage. And I thought Susan Hussey is still very much alive.
She is alive.
Yeah, she is really, you can feel, you know, this kind of, you know, there are more important things in life that we can't dismiss because they are actually what we need to survive.
Yes, and may I also say that Aubrey Hampton, her husband, who is our producer, saw this play 200 times on Broadway.
You're kidding me.
No, and when 200? I said, well, there's a secret. He was selling ice cream. While he was getting his PhD in organic chemistry at NYU. So as a consequence, there's a real reason for the gorilla to be doing the lark. It is deep in the historical bones of all of us who were being raised in the 50s. It's time to look at this play again.
Well, and you mentioned the 50s, Lillian Hellman.
Yes.
How more appropriate that, you know, she was pulled before the House Un-American
Committee. Yes, she was.
She refused to give names. And perhaps the ultimate insult to a woman of that kind of brilliance, et cetera, that they didn't actually censure her because they said, oh, well, she's just a woman.
Well, then.
I mean, really. I mean, but I thought, wow, this is coming full circle.
No, I don't think they were wanting to take on Lillian Hellman.
Well,
because
smart.
She was sharp-penned and sharp-tongued. And I think they would have regretted it. She would have shorn them, I think. Yes, if there are certain ways in which the House Un-American Activities Committee is present in the medieval church.
Like the Inquisition, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And not unlike kind of the some of the groups right now, you know, that do you pass the moral test, you know, which we know exactly, you know, what they are. And we see it. And so Again, and what we've been talking about, listeners, is The Lark, and it's at the Gorilla Theater right now. It started March 11th, and Nancy, it goes through April 4th, right?
Yes, it does. We have two shows on closing day, which is Easter, which strike us as very appropriate.
It is. And so it's Thursday through Sunday, Friday.
Yes, Thursday night is 7 o'clock. Friday and Saturday is 8 o'clock. And also, we have matinees at 3 o'clock on Sundays. We have a talk back on Thursday nights for people who would be particularly interested in coming and telling us what they think or exploring the play with us. And the number for Megalee, how about you do that? Reservations.
The number is 813-879-2914.
Well, congratulations, and it is a tour de force. I really, when I got out of there, and the weather was perfectly awful the other night, I thought, wow, I have really spent a fantastic night.
Did you notice that the rain stopped during the show?
Well, I thought I heard it pouring, but
it stopped about 5 minutes into the show and then started again once the show was over.
Oh, maybe I was just caught into the whole intensity of it.
Maybe I was too. I don't know. I hope I was.
Well, it was just outstanding, Nancy. I find anything you're involved with is well worth seeing. You bring such an intellectual, fierce integrity to it that is so worthwhile. We're lucky to have you in our community.
Yes.
And Magdalena, are we lucky to have you in our community?
Thank you.
Wow, I am going to be following you because it was really very a transcendent night. It really was. I really, really enjoyed it. So again, I'm going to go out with Hildegard de Benham because I think
and bring teenagers to see this. I mean, this is especially teenage girls. This is about empowerment for teenagers.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Because I think their hearts are more open to that milieu, if you will. I think as we get older, we get more entrenched and boxed in, and we're not as likely to listen to the best muses in us.
Well, and also, she was a teenager.
Yeah,
she died at 19, so for any high schooler, any 16-year-old high schooler, that's when she started to take everything on. She was when she was 16. So any high school girl can come and then think, well, she did that. What can I do?
And didn't I notice there's a rush for students and
10
seniors?
O'clock. What am I saying?
$10.
Well, we won't give the price, but it's eminently reasonable. we only give M&F prices here. But it's eminently reasonable, and that's like 10 minutes before because the gorilla has, not a lot of seating. But anyway, I thank you so much for coming in because it's a lot of work, and you are physically just amazing.
Thank you.
Again, thank you so much, Joan of Arc at the Gorilla.
Welcome.
Wow. So Hildegard de Benham.